We live in a country of 360 million people. There is no chance to know our leaders or even most of our neighbors in person. And so we have to rely on communication, words and language, to understand the world we live in and the decisions being made in our name. Often, it may seem that the loudest voice is the one that gets heard. But there are inherent risks in communication that may indeed be meant to be heard, but that can inspire concrete action as well. Now, none of this is new, but that fact makes it no less potentially dangerous. In-depth analysis of the process will appear this summer in the form of an important new book, Words on Fire, The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It. Now, I consider this topic to be so urgent that I didn't want to wait until publication, especially since the author's longtime commitment to the Interfaith Alliance Board of Directors makes it harder for him to elude our scheduling staff. And so I am happy to welcome that author, Helio Fred Garcia, back to State of Belief Radio. Fred, thank you for being willing to say yes to this.
Thank you for the invitation, Walton. Honored to be on the program.
We had a brief conversation about this critical issue last year on the show. At that time, we were using the term stochastic terrorism, which you now say is not helpful. Would you talk about why and what better language for this is there?
Well, thank you. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, social scientists and experts on terrorism began to use the phrase stochastic terrorism to refer to acts of violence and mass violence that are provoked by language and that lead people to act on the language and commit violence. And the word stochastic has to do with a principle from statistics and physics of something being statistically predictable, even if it isn't individually predictable. So what stochastic terrorism says is you can anticipate that certain kinds of language will lead to violence with high degrees of predictive precision. You just can't agree that this individual will commit this act of violence against that other individual. That's the principle. And it is relatively commonly discussed in national security, law enforcement, terrorism, and social science circles. The challenge is, to a non-expert audience, that's a very difficult word to say. It's a difficult word to understand, and people's eyes tend to glaze over. So what I have done is to focus not on the statistical probability, but I describe that, but rather I look at who is it who acts on the communication? What is it that they are acting on? And what do they do as a result? And what the national security anti-terrorism literature describes is the people who are motivated to commit acts of violence on hearing communication are essentially lone wolves. They are not part of any active terrorist network. They are individuals acting alone. They plan alone. They equip alone. They choose their targets alone. They are not directed to do something specifically, but they are inspired to do something generally. So I begin that the actor who commits the violence is the lone wolf.
The toughest rhetorical bridge to cross is that from word to action. And you make a compelling case for this, and I want you to go on and explain that point as well.
So the starting point is to know who is it who commits the violence. The second step is to identify what is it that inspires the lone wolf. And it's a communication from a charismatic, dynamic speaker through a medium that has emotional resonance. And that communication may not be recognized by all people as dangerous communication. And so it serves as a kind of dog whistle, as we understand dog whistle politics in the United States. It is recognized by some, and some act on that recognition. So I refer to this as lone wolf whistles, and violence committed by lone wolves who are responding to the lone wolf whistle, I describe as lone wolf whistle violence. And when that violence isn't random, but is planned carefully against a mass target, I call that lone wolf whistle terrorism. One of the challenges of the old words stochastic terrorism is it didn't seem to anticipate insult, exclusion, and violence up to terrorism. But the phenomenon, as we trace the language that has been in the political sphere in the last 5 years and the reactions to that language, is it begins with disinhibition of insult. It moves to acts of random, apparently spontaneous violence against people in suspect groups. And then it ultimately leads to the act of fatal violence and ultimately terrorism. I call acts of random or opportunistic violence triggered by language lone wolf whistle violence. And then when it becomes significant enough to be an act of planned violence against a large group of people, I call that lone wolf whistle terrorism.
So how do we avoid the pitfalls of comparing today's hateful rhetoric to historic examples of similar rhetoric leading to deadly consequences? Because we both know a lot of people tune out from that kind of conversation.
The immediate comparison to past genocides is a politically sensitive comparison, and I'm acutely aware of that. Having said that, in my study of communication and leadership and history, I have identified 12 forms of communication that predictably lead to acts of violence and that historically have led to acts of genocide, and that are often implicated in acts of terror. And I did a systematic assessment with the help of some very gifted researchers, a systematic assessment of the forms of language that historically precede acts of violence, including genocide. And what troubled me as I was hearing the political discourse during the campaign and during the first years of the president's presidency is the forms of language seemed familiar. As I began to dig deeply into the book, I found the patterns that were unmistakable and that are actually easy to recognize once you know what to look for. So these 12 forms of communication I call the lone wolf whistle terrorist playbook. And if you like, I can describe some or all of these 12 forms of communication.
I am interested in knowing, having you talk about at least two or three of those, because these are, if I understand it correctly, identifiable steps that can take words and lead to mass violent action.
They are exactly that. And what I try to do in the book is to describe the phenomenon, show that it is present in our world today, describe how we got here, and then give us a path forward that allows civic leaders and engaged citizens to recognize it early, to name it quickly, and to demand that those who use this kind of language be aware of and responsible for the consequences. I looked at the Nazi genocide, I looked at the Rwandan massacre of Tutsi by the Hutu, and I looked at the current political climate. The first is to dehumanize a suspect group. And that dehumanization includes calling them animals, calling them specific kinds of animals, rats, vermin, calling them an infestation. We saw that in the genocides of the Nazis. We saw that in the genocide of the Hutu against the Tutsi. There, the Hutu referred to the Tutsi as cockroaches and even said a cockroach will never evolve into a butterfly, meaning that they were destined to be vermin. We saw President Trump, as candidate and as president, refer to Mexican immigrants as animals, refer to their presence as an infestation. He was using exactly the same forms of language. And not only does referring to them as animals dehumanize members of that group, but one of the things I describe in the book is that kind of language conditions a society to be less empathetic towards members of that group and more normalizing of acts that would otherwise be seen as inhumane. So when you see the people who have been described as animals and their presence as an infestation being held in squalid cages and children separated from their parents, that is a predictable consequence as government policy of labeling human beings less than human. And that's the first play in the Lone Wolf Whistle Terrorism playbook, to dehumanize. Another is to severely exaggerate the nature of the threat. So starting in the spring of 2018, President Trump described migrants who were essentially immigrants who have internationally protected, international law protected rights. He referred to them as an invasion. And that invasion, he said, was created by governments intentionally sending their worst people to the United States to wreak havoc. And he said that the invaders were infiltrated by Middle Easterners who were also trying to sneak in through the caravan, and that the caravan was funded by sinister sounding people in order to destabilize the United States. The people he was talking to and referring to as an invasion were essentially refugees without any resources, struggling to escape abject poverty and violence and famine to get their children to a safer place. And instead of treating them as refugees, they were labeled an imminent threat to the United States. The United States military was mobilized, even though the military under American law is not permitted to engage in immigration activities or law enforcement activities. And just to show that this was all for political benefit, the military deployed to Texas, even though the destination of the so-called caravan of invaders was San Diego, 1,500 miles away. But that persistent pounding on invader, invasion, imminent threat intensified and accelerated through the campaign. And President Trump used some form of invader or invasion 5 to 7 times in the normal course of the early part of the midterm election campaign. But by the last weeks, he was using some form of invader or invasion fully 35 to 40 times a day. And every time he would say it, it would be amplified in social media and white supremacist media. And that's where I began sending out signals on social media in October 2018 about stochastic terrorism. And I said, someone is going to be killed by this language of invader. And sure enough, 10 days before the election, a white supremacist went into the Tree of Life synagogue fully armed, and he killed 11 people. He wounded many others. And what is fascinating to me, and I cover this in the book, is he, 10 days before he attacked the synagogue, posted on his white supremacist site, "I see we've stopped calling them illegal aliens. We now call them invaders. I like this." He then got more and more agitated in social media posts saying that the Jews were funding the invasion and we've got to stop it. And then he targeted a particular organization, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and said they are the ones who are bringing the invaders in. And on the day of the shooting, He posted, I'm tired of Hayas bringing in invaders to slaughter our people. Screw the optics. I'm going in. And 2 hours later, he committed the act of terror. He was clearly triggered by the language of invasion. He had never committed an act of violence before. He was using the very language that the president had used and that had been amplified in mainstream media, in social media, and then in white supremacist media. It was that event that compelled me to stop what I was doing and to begin to study this phenomenon more carefully and more thoroughly. And here we are 15, 16 months later, and I've turned it into a book not only about the phenomenon, but about how to recognize it and how to stop it.
Despite the coronavirus crisis being a new challenge facing humanity, I can't help but think of how well the principles you're talking about apply to this moment of terror and uncertainty. What are the ways a demagogue would try to leverage this moment to consolidate even more power?
Well, we have seen that happening from initially saying that the problem was with people in China, and as a result, people from China became more and more at risk. And what one of the things that we have seen is a rise in incivility, first against people based on the perception of their national origin, and second on what they happen to be wearing over their faces. And the language that the virus itself is a democratic hoax is extraordinarily dangerous. And there are people who believe it. And one of the things I do in the book is I talk about why do people believe that kind of thing. It's a process called motivated reasoning. But in terms of the language that is happening today, when the president labels the disease a foreign disease, a foreign virus. Well, viruses don't have nationality, but labeling it a foreign disease means anyone from somewhere else is suddenly suspect. The other language that he uses is the language of travel ban. And as a commentator said on television recently, when the only solution you have is a wall, everything is framed as an invasion. The idea that the travel ban is the solution as opposed to lack of adequate testing and treatment alternatives and hospital beds, et cetera, is from a public health standpoint extremely dangerous, but from a social cohesion standpoint, even more dangerous. And one of the things we saw in the president's recent Oval Office address was his referring to the need to stop people from coming from different parts of the world. And then he said, oh, there will be exceptions. We saw exactly the same thing during the campaign when he called for a total and complete ban of Muslims entering the United States. And then when he was pressed on it, he said, oh, well, the good ones will be allowed in. Americans will be allowed in. Well, how could it be total and complete if certain people will be allowed in, but you don't tell us what the criteria are? When he did the actual travel ban as president, he initially banned people with green cards, and the government was completely confused about whether people with green cards could come in or not. And ultimately, they changed that travel ban. But travel ban seems to be the go-to tool for this particular president, but it is, from a policy perspective, incoherent. Why is he doing that? I can't attribute motive, but I can say that one of the predictable consequences, we saw it during the call for Muslims not being allowed to enter the country, we saw it during the actual travel ban in his first months as president, and we're seeing it now, is it stigmatizes whole parts of the population and puts those parts of the population at risk. And I, as you may know, Welton, I teach in various universities in New York City and elsewhere. We're now teaching virtually. But one of the things that I have found is in those universities, students who are seen to be from other countries have been horribly treated by American students. Faculty who are seen to be from other countries have been horribly treated. And the virus is not their fault. And they are as much victims of the virus as anyone else. But one of the consequences of the kind of language that the president uses is it creates an us-them. And the philosopher of fascism, Jason Stanley at Yale University, says one of the hallmarks of fascist politics is the creation of an us and them and pitting us against them as an existential threat. We saw that in the presidency, and the kind of language the president is using now in the COVID-19 crisis is precisely the kind of language that creates an us and them.
Helio Fred Garcia is founder and president of the crisis management firm Logos Consulting Group and teaches at Columbia University and NYU. Fred has been a fixture on the Interfaith Alliance Board of Directors since 2007, and he has served as chair of the board. Fred Garcia's new book, Words on Fire, The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It, will be published on June 30th. It is available now for pre-order, and we will have the benefit of his presence again in June to continue this conversation. Fred, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My honor, Welton. Thank you.